accession number 20065, reel 5.
Janusz Kazieniewski, reel 5.
Yes. Well, and you see, the Germans started shooting. Before you get to the barrack, everybody had to be inside the barrack. And if you were outside walking, for instance, say to the turret, like in case of myself, they started firing. And they shot the people inside the barrack on their beds. And, well, this is what happened. Well, then another thing is that on our beds, there were, they called them koika, there were three level beds, and on one bed there were about 10 or 12 people, and they were so close to each other that in the night you couldn't turn over. If you wanted to turn over, you have to get up, sit down, turn over, and sink again between the other two people. Well, when I came first time to Auschwitz, we came in the evening from Warsaw, and the journey probably took about 24 hours. So I was very tired, and they unloaded us in Auschwitz, and we walked to Birkenau. And in Birkenau, they wouldn't let us inside the barrack, but we had to stay all night outside. And it was cold evening, and I lay down, and I fell asleep. And when I woke up in the morning, I slept so soundly that for a few minutes I didn't know where I am. I was looking around myself, and I just forgotten that I'm in Auschwitz. And it took me a few minutes before I realized that it's Auschwitz. And then, well, should I come? I just wanted to mention another thing in Auschwitz, that one, on the Sunday afternoon, when we didn't work, some people managed to get boxing gloves, and at the end of this compound, they staged a boxing match. There was a Polish boxer and some Dutch boxer, I think. You know, I'm not interested very much in boxing, so I don't know, but I heard the name of this man before the war. And some of the people in the concentration, even in Auschwitz, in other concentration camps, they had access, they had friends and so on. So they had quite a good food. Some of them didn't have anything, but some of them were eating. Say if they were working in the kitchen, they had access to the food and they could eat as much as they wanted. Or if they were near crematorium and doing something in crematorium, people were being brought to crematorium, probably they had access to food as well, and probably other things who could exchange for the food. So some of the people also had an easy job, and, well, it is like in normal life, to some extent, except that this life there was like in order to achieve, to get the same experience which you got in a year, in normal life, you probably had to live 30 years to notice it, you know what is happening. So it was a kind of a concentrated essence of the life and the relation of one human being to another, and how do they behave. And there were moments for some people, well, although everybody's life was threatened, but at short intervals, some people were much better off than the other, because some of them starved and another were well off. And quite often Germans didn't bother about this thing, because how these people got the boxing gloves, I don't really know. But they were quite strong, they looked quite well. Anyway, they started boxing at the end of the compound. And I went there as well, and there were trenches. And suddenly, I heard the swearing of the German SS man who was walking from the crematorium towards the gate. And he took the gun and started firing to us in the middle of this boxing and shouting, "You Farfluchten, Banditen," and this kind of a swearing. And a few people were shot, and whether they were wounded or killed, I'm not very sure, because my feet there were trenches there, and I sat on the edge of the trench with my feet inside the trench. So instinctively, I dropped into the trench, and I crawled to the end of the trench and came out of it very carefully. When the end of the trench was at the end of the barrack, and when everything was quiet and harsh, I just put my head around and I saw that the SS man was gone. So I very quickly jumped and went behind the barracks, and I lost my shoes, because there were these kind of a clogs, I don't know what they are called, you know, that only on your on the toes and the wooden soles, and then I had one shoe. From somebody else, and not because quite a lot of people lose these shoes. So I had one shoe from someone else and another shoe from other person. And then as I walked, well, not immediately afterwards, but the day after, one big, huge man, much bigger than myself, came and started shouting, "Muni, you got my shoe, you got my shoe." So I had to give him away my shoe, which I have picked up. Probably he lost it there as well, and he gave me two. So still, I didn't lose anything there, because I had the two shoes, but from different legs, but what shows what was happening in this concentration camp. So after this work. Then I started working out another work which I was doing in the concentration camp in Auschwitz, in Birkenau, was that we had to go somewhere outside, not very far from Auschwitz, well, on the outer camp, pick a big stone and bring it to the crematorium. And we were making flower beds in this crematorium. It was November and so on. And there were no flowers, but we had to put a kind of a flower bed and put the soil inside it and so on. And it was also very tiring, because we were not going very fast, but we would go with the German guard, one or two soldiers, probably a kilometer or so, pick the stone and carry the stone, and we are starved and hungry all the time. So the job wasn't very easy. It was very cold. We didn't have a proper clothing. So. And once there were small groups walking with one assessman or two assessmen, there and back. And then I thought that I'm going to miss one of these rounds. So there was a hut very near crematorium, and when SS weren't looking, I thought there was a toilet there. I thought I'd go into this toilet and stay for a while, probably half an hour or three quarters of an hour, so I miss my round and I will have a bit of rest. But when I opened the door, I stumbled on something. It was quite completely dark. And then when my eyes got used to this darkness, I noticed that the thing I stumbled was in a dead corpse, and the house was full of corpses. So I very quickly came out as I came in, and I joined my turn and went again carrying this stone. But also in this crematorium was a hospital, so we had a lunch break. Three quarter of hours or so, and they're giving something, some kind of a watery soup. And near crematorium was hospital. So I'm always curious in life, and I'm not so really frightened of anything, of everything. So I wasn't even frightened of everything in Germany. And in a way, I was breaking a bit of a German rules. And I did what was not allowed really to do, and I went towards this hospital, and in hospital there was a lot of Polish people, and they started talking to me, and because there were prisoners who were there much longer than I was only a novice, you know, so I didn't know what was going around, you know, what was happening in the camp as much as they did, and They started giving me food. So, well, come here whenever you are near our hospital, came because we are too sick to eat our food, so we can give you. And some of us are getting even more food, so we don't mind giving you. So then for a week or two, I was fed a little bit better because the sick people were giving me their food from hospital. And this crematorium, which I am describing, I think that later on was blown up by Jewish rebels, but I'm not very sure about it. Working at the crematorium, I mean making flour at the crematorium, it was my last job in Auschwitz. But what I would like also to mention, that there was a lot of, there were a lot of Jewish people coming, probably most of the people who were, not probably, I'm sure now, that most of the people who were killed there, they were Jewish people, but at the time there was not this ramp, not the railway, so they were brewing, we could see them, Jewish people were, whenever they were burying them, killing them, we had to go inside the barracks because everybody had to be, they were not allowed to see them because we see them before killing. But after killing, we couldn't see, we didn't know where the killing was going. But usually there was order for all of us to go to the barracks and close the doors and so on. And then we saw these people going in trucks towards this crematorium where I was making flower beds. And then afterwards, the smoke was coming out of the chimneys, you know, kind of a burning human flesh. And the thought of what we knew that they were burying Jewish people, but we also knew that they were killing Polish people and burying them as well. So whenever this thing was happening, psychologically was very, very upsetting, not only that they were killing the people, but there was always thought that I am going to be next one, and the only way to defend yourself against this thought, there was not really defense, but for myself, I used to get tired with these thoughts, really. So in the end, you know, it was going on and on and on and on. I just became indifferent to it. Not emotionally indifferent, but just indifferent because I couldn't really, because I was exhausted, really, with these things. So you have to, another way of getting used to it is that you agree that it's going to happen. Well, they kill me, what then? They kill me, that's it, you know, there's going to be the end of it. But psychologically, you just give up, you know. In a way, you don't exactly give up, but just agree that it's going to be end of you, and then somehow you settle down and are more at peace with your mind. But I wasn't really, although in Auschwitz, I wasn't beaten in Auschwitz, really, and Mauthausen. So anyway, but once they parted me from my father, one day, they took him away, and he went to Auschwitz. I didn't want to stay in Auschwitz. Of course, nobody wanted to stay in Auschwitz, but I just was all the time thinking, you know, how to get out of this Auschwitz. I'm Birkenau. When my father was there, this thought never mentioned to me because I wanted to be near my father. But afterwards, I was all the time thinking how to get out of Birkenau, probably go to Auschwitz, probably see my father, then so on and so on. And one day, I saw there was a queue in our camp. So I asked the people what they are queuing for. Oh, they are forming the transport for another concentration camp, to another camp. Which camp? We don't know. So I just stood in the queue. So I thought that now I think that even in Auschwitz you could have a bit of your own initiative in this respect. So I stood in the queue without asking anybody. Probably I wasn't breaking some kind of an order. And then when my turn come up, I entered the barrack, and there was a German sitting, some SS man sitting on the chair, and asked me to undress, and asked me to stand on the brick flue, which was coming from, there was stove in the barracks, and there was a flue from the end to the end, but they were never used, but this flue, because there were so many people, it was always too hot anyway, with the, just with the crowd of the people, so they never used this thing as a fire, at least during my time. And then I had to move around, and he put me on the list. And couple of weeks afterwards, out of these people, they formed the transport, and then before the transport, we didn't know where we were going to, but there were gossip going around that we are going to Mauthausen. And we did. They formed the transport out of us and thus marched us back to Auschwitz again. And in Auschwitz, again, we stood all night probably November as well, late November. We stood there all night between the barracks. And there I saw last time my father, but we were isolated, not SS guards was watching us, my couples. And in the morning, before the departures, I saw my father standing between the other barracks, and I waved to him, and then he approached one of these guards and asked them whether he can see me. And he said, yes, go, but only for a very short time. So he came to me, he gave me a loaf of bread and cheered me up and so on and so on. And then they told him to go away. And the next morning, this was when I last time saw my father. And the next morning, they put us into the cattle wagons, and we started traveling. And I had a loaf of bread from my father and half a loaf of bread from German. They gave each prisoner half a loaf of bread, and then put us into cattle wagons. I don't know how many of us there inside, in each of them, probably 50. And they locked us, and we traveled like that for 3 days to Auschwitz. We only traveled probably 24 hours to Auschwitz from Warsaw. But from Auschwitz to Mauthausen, we traveled 3 days. And it was really, really exhausting, very exhausting, because they never let us go to the toilet. And they never gave us anything to drink, and it was so stuffy and hot. And although I had the bread, but I couldn't eat it because I didn't have enough saliva in my mouth. And the bread was really hurting my mouth when I was eating it. You know, it was nothing, no moisture, nothing. Mouth was completely dry. So in the end, we arrived to Mauthausen station, and we arrived in the evening, so they kept us all night again in this wagon, but in the morning started unloading us. This night we were on the wagon in Mauthausen, we heard beating and shouting next wagon to us, you know, the one in front, because I was in the second wagon from engine. It was another one in front of us. So we found out afterwards that in this wagon, one Polish man broke the planks, removed the plank from the floor of the wagon, and he escaped. And the German discovered this thing in on the sidings in Mauthausen station, and they were so furious that they were beating everybody in this wagon, and even they tried to hang one man. I found it afterwards, because speaking with these people who were in this wagon, they were walking, they ordered them to sit inside the wagon, and they were walking over the top of their heads and beating them and shouting them and firing. And they took one man who was nearest, and they wanted to hang the man. And there was a hook in the ceiling, and they put a strap, trouser strap, around his neck, but the strap broke. So he wasn't hung. They didn't try to hang him again, but he had a broken ribs. And I spoke to the man afterwards. As a matter of fact, I think this person who were going to hang him, he survived the camp. And when I opened our wagon, I was so dazed by the fresh air that I fell sideways out of the rank. But German hit me with the butt of his rifle, and well, it sobered me up, and I went back into my ranks, and then went from there to Mauthausen. In Mauthausen camp itself, we stayed again, but this time in the barrack. We stayed the night there, and in the morning they marched us to our final destination, which was Gusen. Gusen was a satellite camp, but was the biggest camp. There were about 20 or 30 satellite camps. I don't remember how many to Mauthausen. Mauthausen was the main camp, and the Gusen was a bigger than the main camp. I mean, bigger in, there were more people there. There was Gusen 1, and Gusen 2 was built afterwards when they enlarged the camp. And in the morning they marched us to Gusen, and because we were half dressed, we had these cloaks on our feet, this striped clothing, but there were no buttons and nothing. We didn't have any belts or nothing to hold our, well, they were not really trousers, they were like a pyjamas in a way. And so we had to hold these pyjamas and whatever it was with our arms. And as we walked, it was snowing at the time, but it wasn't freezing. It was more or less probably zero, because snow was melting very quickly, probably 1 or 2, I'm not sure how cold, but it was very cold. And the German people, Austrian people, were looking at us, you know, because we walked through some kind of a village and so on. So they're looking at us. And on the way, I think from Mauthausen to Gusen was probably 4 or 5 kilometers. So it took some time to get there. And some of the people were so exhausted that they collapsed, and were ordered to carry them. And I was one of them who had the order to carry, but I don't even know whether the man was alive or dead, because he just collapsed. So the Sesman taught us to pick him up, 4 of us, one to each, one to one hand, another hand leg, and another leg. So the way we carried him, like a kind of an inanimate object, and we didn't really, well, it was no point really thinking whether he's dead or alive, and we just carried, that's it. But then after a while, well, I was tired, and probably other people just as well. We started stumbling, and we didn't carry him anymore. So this assessment noticed it, and he called another foreman, told us to put him down, and they picked him up. So by the time we were out to Gusen itself, there was probably 10 or 15 people. We had all of us who had stand to attention, they were counting us, and probably several people were lying all dead or unconscious on the ground because they just couldn't stand the ordeal. And because of our the way we were dressed, well, or undressed, they called us naked transport. Afterwards, in the camp, we were referred as the naked transport, because we were really half naked, you know, because after we were so cold, it was easier to let your trousers down and carry them into the hunt and have a jacket on, because it was difficult, for instance, to carry the man and hold your trousers at the same time. We didn't have any straps. So we stayed there all night, like that, naked, and in the mornings, they let us into the barrack, and I registered our names and all this, allotted us to different barracks and so on and so on. And usually in the concentration camp, the same applies to Auschwitz. The first few weeks is a quarantine, so that means that the people are, they still have to go to work, but they're on the separate barracks. I don't know whether it was for a health reason, or probably Germans were frightened that typhus or something of this kind would spread. So I was for about a week or 2 weeks on this quarantine, but from there I was already started going to the quarry, working in the quarry. And when they lifted quarantine, we were just living, doing the same thing, really. I don't know why they call it quarantine, because we were doing the same things and going to the quarry. And the quarry, and it was winter already there, and it was at the foothills of Alps, and was quite cold and wet, and was quite a lot of snow. So we would go in the quarry at the sunrise, and then coming in the evening, it was already evening, and every day we were coming back, we had to carry dead people, because people were collapsing there, people were killed by Germans, especially one couple whose favorite way of killing was to kick the man in the groin and then put a stick on his head and suffocate him. And my job was, well, carrying the stone, putting them on the bogies, on the trolley, bogies on the rails, and we're pushing them towards Schotterzilo, which is in English, stone crusher. And in the stone crusher was the worst job, but I didn't do this work in the stone crusher because people used to get lung diseases that never lasted for a long time. So I worked in this quarry for some time, and one day I met a Pole, forgotten his name now, who was tailor, and he worked in some people who had some kind of a profession, like tailors, shoemakers, and so on, they were working in the, he was working in the tailor shop, tailor workshop, and they were making uniform for SS. I don't know, for prisoners as well, but I think mainly SS. So he had a word with a SS man for whom he made a uniform, and he asked me whether he could give me a bit better job. So one day, during lunch break, we had a lunch break about an hour in this quarry, and during the lunch break they would give us half a liter of soup, which was very lucky if you got a potato inside it, but usually it was kind of a very, very watery. And for breakfast we had nothing, just half a liter of some kind of ersatz coffee. And during the lunch break, they were blowing, they're putting the explosive charges into the stones and blowing the stones so you would pick them in the afternoon and next morning. So they were blowing them twice, morning and in the evening. So one during the roll call, and the Germans have roll calls and orders. And one day, they called a number, because in the camp we were not called by name, but each of us was allotted a number. So they called my number, and of course I didn't notice it, you know, because about a couple of thousand people standing there, and they called my number. And then suddenly I realized that it's my number, so I was rather frightened to be picked up out of the crowd like that, with assessment together with this couple who is killing people, and they asked me to come forward. But I went, and what happened, this SS man asked Capo to give me a little bit easier job on the intervention of this man.